Welcome to Generation Now, the show by and for millennials and Gen Z. I'm your host, Troy McDonald. The last 3 weeks have reshaped America. We witnessed domestic terror that gripped the nation on January 6th. 1 week later, Trump's second impeachment. And then on Wednesday, the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Where do we go from here? What's next? What do we demand as young people of this new administration? And how do we reconcile what we've gone through? I'm here today with one of the nation's premier thought leaders on race and race relations and so much more, and someone I'm so excited to talk to today. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute. Please welcome Dr. Rayshon Ray. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me on the show. I look forward to this very important conversation.
I've asked a lot of my guests, and especially my guests of people of color, this same first question. How are you doing? Just over the last 4 years, last 3 weeks, just how are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough time. I mean, for me, I always think about how people around me are doing. And oftentimes, if they are okay, that makes me feel better. I mean, obviously, we are in a very difficult time. I mean, even transitioning with a new president, for, you know, overwhelmingly that Black people and young people and people of color wanted to be in president versus to be in office versus the other person. Look, my wife is a frontline healthcare provider. She runs her own clinic. So, you know, we have two kids. They're remote learning. But I mean, every day my wife goes out of the house, and when she gets to work, she has to wear 2 pairs of gloves, 2 masks, eye goggles, and a face shield, along with a surgery gown. So I'm sitting at home, working from home, just making sure that our kids continue to learn and do what they have to do. So relatively speaking, compared to my wife and our other family members who are on the front lines, you know, what I'm facing isn't nothing compared to what they're facing. And, you know, they continue to be our heroes. And I think we need to continue to realize that this is kind of their war in a sense. I mean, this has been going on for a year. I mean, I've watched my wife leave the house like this every single day for a year. And so, you know, when I reflect on it, I mean, look, I think we're doing fine, relatively speaking. It's a tough time and we just continue to push through. I mean, we're following the science. We know that people are starting to get vaccinated. My wife has received her vaccine, as well as some of my other family members. And hopefully over the next 6 months or so, a very large percentage of Americans will have also received their vaccine and people can start to get back to some sense of normalcy, particularly as it relates to kids going to school and people going to work who have been out of work. I mean, we know particularly in the area where you're located at, it's hit that particular area extremely hard in terms of COVID, but also in terms of the economy. So, you know, we need to follow the science. We need to get vaccinated so that hopefully we can get back to people being able to go to work and kids being able to go to school.
And as a scholar yourself, who of course needs your time to do your work, how do you explain what you're going through, what your wife is going through, what their mom and dad are going, what your children's parents are going through? What are those conversations like?
Yeah, I mean, they are interesting conversations. So we have a 10-year-old and a soon to be 9-year-old as of next week. And, you know, they ask very inquisitive questions. The way I think about parenting, and look, I mean, we're just kind of halfway through this, but based on the way my mom raised me and the way we're doing with our kids, they are very, very good boys. If they're mature enough to ask a question, they're mature enough to get a really good response. So the way we like to process it, they know that mommy's going to work. We actually got to FaceTime. This is the power of technology. We actually got to FaceTime and see mommy get her vaccine. That was a powerful moment for them to see that happening for her and us being able to watch even from home via technology. When it comes to the inauguration, for example, we watched that. We talked about the Capitol insurgency. I mean, any conversations they have, we talk about, they know about Black Lives Matter protests. They know about what's going on there. I mean, obviously the work I do on policing and health disparities, I mean, they know what's going on. So when they ask a question, we give them an answer. And then we always leave it with, your generation has the ability to change this for the better. If these are things that you're hearing that you don't agree with, that you don't like, that you don't think are correct, well, what are you gonna do as you grow up? You can never be too young or too old to make a difference and be the change you wanna see and that you wanna be. So we aim to empower them, to give them information and knowledge, to then make better decisions and hopefully step outside of themselves as they have continued to do, to make good decisions moving forward.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I've had those same conversations, and I'm 29, and I've had those with my mother, right, who was born in this country without the right to vote, right? And so for her to witness what happened on Wednesday was a moment within itself. I wanted to talk about the insurgency. And I don't think people are really discussing how close we came to something even more catastrophic. But also I want to talk about how if it someone or people like us that look like us, Black men, were on those, it would have been a very, very different reaction. I don't think we would have gotten anywhere near that. So just talk about how close we came to seeing an even, I mean, it was already catastrophic. People lost their lives, so we don't want to minimize, but it could have been tremendously worse. And then talk about how we saw the Confederate flag just roaming around, people peaceably walking around, taking selfies, not even recognizing. What does that say?
You know, I really don't think people recognize the way that white supremacy is normalized in our country. To have the Confederate flag, a noose, a Camp Auschwitz shirt, Black police officers being called the N-word repeatedly. I mean, those are aspects of white supremacy at their heart. And I really don't think people understand how close we were and potentially still how close we are to a civil war. That this is how the Civil War started. This is how Nazi Germany started. I actually taught a course at the University of Mannheim. It's been over a decade ago now, but lived in Germany for over 6 months, taught graduate students from multiple countries and studied Nazism while I was there. And this is the way that it started. You take away people's confidence in government. You take away people's trust in the media. You take away people's knowledge and insights about science and medicine. And collectively what that does is it leads to a cult leader becoming more powerful than they should be, because people are confused about what are facts versus alternative facts, which are really just fake facts and lies and misinformation. So I really don't think people realized how close we got to that a few weeks ago, and how the Biden-Harris administration have an uphill battle to turn things around. It's interesting politically working on the Hill that I really don't think people understand some of the political theater that goes into what we see when the cameras are on these politicians. I mean, as an example, yes, there were still a lot of people in Congress who voted against Joe Biden becoming president. These people were Republicans, of course, but a majority of them turned course in that same exact day, that same exact moment. That lets you know the level of political theater that it was about, that it wasn't really real. It was about symbolism. And when you engage in symbolism and that symbolism affects people's lives, their livelihood and generations in the future, you are doing a grave injustice to the people who put you in office and that you're supposed to be serving. So when I think about it, I always think about the fact that this is what America is. This is what America has always been. And part of what happens, and I wrote this in Brookings, is that we buy into American exceptionalism. We buy into this thought that some sort of way that our democracy is actually equitable, and that our country really is the land of the free. And oftentimes those things can be farther from the truth. when you start to look at the way that inequality manifests in our lives. I mean, and we only have to look at what happened in 2020 and what's continuing to happen in 2021 around COVID disparities, the fact that Black people are three times more likely than whites to die from COVID. That's because we're six times more likely to be turned away from testing and treatment. I mean, we only have to look at Dr. Moore in Indianapolis, up the road from where I got my PhD at in Indiana, to actually realize the way that manifests. We also know that Black people are 3.5 times more likely to be killed by police when we're not attacking or have a weapon. Of course, that's George Floyd, and there are several others whose names we don't exactly know, but people should know. So we recognize that there are huge inequalities in our country, in our healthcare system, in our criminal justice system, in our economy, the legacy of redlining and the like. And Donald Trump injected a steroid of hate into the American mainstream, not the extreme, into the American mainstream, that this is who America is. And if we want to do something about it, and if people are scared when they hear that, when they actually admit that we are not exceptional and that we are still engaging in what four-star Marine General John Allen, who's the president of Brookings, always says, that we are continuing to forge ahead in our democratic experiment, that we are still a very young country in an experimental phase toward democracy, that every instance it can be shattered and we have to keep pushing forward. Oftentimes people think that progress just kind of keeps going down the train tracks. Like, oh, you know, if I'm just on the train, we're just going to keep being able to go. We're just going to move toward progress. No, we have to continuously activate it and push towards it. Why? Because as Congressman Akeem Jeffries said when I interviewed him, he said, we have a genetic birth defect on the question of race. And that genetic birth defect has to continuously be worked upon and held at bay. And we see those links with the government and law enforcement. There were police officers, Kiki and Ha Ha, and with domestic terrorists. There was these white supremacists at the Capitol while their colleagues were being chased, being beaten, being called the N-word. Like, this is America. And we have to be willing to admit that. That one of the things I say about law enforcement is that bad apples come from rotten trees in policing. Well, the domestic terrorists who stormed the Capitol come from those same rotten trees, and the roots of those trees are laced with white supremacy.
And it's so interesting you say that this is who we are. And I think people of color, specifically Black people, all you have to do is ask your mom or your dad, right? Right. I mean, one of the most, I've never shared this on air, so people are going to get a new story. But one of the most formidable stories I ever heard was my mom telling me that in the 1970s, she went down to Texas in the early 1970s with her friend, as most 20-somethings do. They go down and with her friends. She went to a bar and they poured wine on her and they said, N-word, go home. 20 years later, she has me. And she said that she never recovered from that, that it stained every interaction she had with us. And so she would always stand outside when we were playing, right? She didn't allow us to have cell phones until we were 13 years old. And she said, it all stems from that moment, because I never wanted to be out of sight in case somebody did that to you.
Yeah.
And that, so I kind of grew up, I didn't know about that story until much later in my 20s, but it made sense, right? It connected those dots. I find it interesting that you talk about how close we still are potentially to a civil war. That's a statement. Some people would say, well, he's shut down on Twitter. He shut down on all these social media platforms. The president, former President Trump, who many say stoked a lot of, well, he did stoke a lot of this animus in the culture. What would you say to that? Well, he silenced, he shut up, that's over. We can just move on to the Biden administration, you know, kumbaya, hippie-kaye, right? What would you say to that? What's the threat?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. Well, I mean, first, thank you for telling that story of you and your mom. I mean, I have a similar story growing up in Atlanta. And I think that is the key current, is that we have these collective memories of trauma that continuously run through our generations that never get lost. And, you know, one of the things that your mom continues to experience as a parent that I do is after you have kids, you never sleep the same again, partly because your kids, sometimes your kids don't sleep. Like my 10-year-old is up at 6 a.m. every morning. But the other thing about being a Black parent is you never sleep the same again, because unfortunately, I know, and particularly being the parent and the father of Black boys, that there are things that I will never be able to protect them from. You know, someone asked me recently, they say, well, I always talk about what it means for your kids to go from cute to criminal. Like when they're kids, they're cute. You know, the people look at them, they think they're cute. And then instantaneously, they get framed and stereotyped as potential criminals. Like when does that happen? How quick does that happen? You know, someone said, well, when does that happen? Are they in high school? Are they 14, 15? And I said, well, maybe I used to think that. And then Tamir Rice got killed at 12 playing with a toy gun in a park. Like the trauma that comes along with the inability to protect your child from an ideology that comes out in hate and manifests in people's behavior and discriminatory treatment against them is, I mean, it's so traumatic that it's difficult for people to make sense of. And Trump has helped to continuously inflame this. And even though if he's not on Twitter or not on Facebook or these other outlets, part of what he's going to do, I think, is not only is Parler, which is now the right wing kind of extreme portion of social media, now essentially being funded and routed through Russian organizations, which is scary in and of itself. I mean, that shouldn't be any surprise to people. 4 years ago, people talked about the way that Russia was infiltrating our government, our media, and the aspects of our society, and that Trump and some of them were probably working with them. And now we're starting to, I think, make the links. I think he's also going to create an alternative media platform, which shouldn't be surprising. I mean, that's part of what he's done throughout his career. And part of doing that, if you look at who he's going to get, Fox News, this is one thing that people need to understand. For the past 20 years, essentially, since pretty much like 9/11, which is coming up on 20 years, which is very, very interesting and kind of spooky to think about. Because I remember exactly where I was when that happened. I was in college and that came down. And Fox News has been running the show for 20 years. Cable news, blowing CNN and MSNBC, headline news, all them out of the water. For the first time in 20 years, CNN retook, well, for one of the first times in 20 years, CNN took number one and MSNBC took number two since the election. Because when Fox News said that Donald Trump was going to lose and they called Arizona, there were a lot of Republicans who balked at that, completely went off the grid. They went to Parler. They went to these other outlets, and now they're going to follow Trump to the depths of wherever he goes. And it's going to continue to be a growing fringe part of our society who, and this is what's key for people to understand. Like when people say, who are these people? Let me tell you who these people are, because it's not like it's all white people, right? Like that's not what we're talking about at all. And that becomes important to disaggregate them. There are, I think, two main groups though. And then within them, you can make some subgroups, but the two main groups are people who really buy into equality and the fact that they know that we still haven't reached racial or gender equality. So we need to continue to make headway with that, versus people who think that something has been taken from them, that something has been stolen from them. These are the Kyle Rittenhouses of the world, right? Who cross state lines and then shoot people and walk down the street with a rifle and police say, just go home. They don't arrest somebody.
Not only that, they gave him a water bottle. We posted that video on our social here in Kenosha. They gave him a water bottle.
Gave him some water. Oh, here goes some water. Yeah, we know you just killed some. We know you just killed somebody. You just killed what at the time were peaceful protesters. But here goes some water. Good job. You know, you just came out of the game. You did a good job on that last play. I mean, that is the type of thing that we think about that he is creating, and what these people are saying. Their attitudes, what they're thinking, explicitly and implicitly, is that our country is being stolen from us. Our country, meaning the United States of America, was created for people like us. It was created for Europeans who left Europe and who came to America to found this country. And we are storming the Capitol because we are its rightful heirs, not only the Capitol as a symbolic representation of democracy for us, but also the United States of America. We are reclaiming it for us and only us. And either you are here to serve us or you can get out of the country. That is what they think. And whenever they see a successful Black person or a successful Latino person or a successful Asian person, and for a lot of them, a successful woman, they think that something is being taken away from them. And those people are the people who Trump is really able to mobilize and radicalize. And I do think that Biden, I think President Biden is going to be able to unify. But I think ultimately what has to happen here is when I think about people's households, most people's households look like theirs. I mean, yeah, it's a growing percentage of households that are ethnically and racially diverse. But overall, people's households, who they live in a house with, who they eat dinner with, who sleeps in their home, look like them. And until white people who are in that first category I mentioned, who know that equity still needs to be pursued and really buy into it, until they really start standing up and speaking to that other group, who, mind you, are their neighbors, are their coworkers, are their friends, are their family members, until they start speaking up to them, we won't be able to deal with this new fringe group that has developed. And one thing my grandfather always said, who served in two wars, Purple Heart, Bronze Star, he always said, your silence is your acceptance. So when they're silent, they are accepting what is going on. They become complicit. MLK talked about that explicitly, that he was most disappointed with the white moderate. He was most disappointed at the silence of his so-called friends. And I do think that white people are starting to mobilize. I mean, look, we've seen with Black Lives Matter protests, the most racially diverse protests we've ever seen. And we are seeing young people in their 20s and in their teens taking their parents to task, which part of that I think is engaging in virtual learning and remote school, where they're at home and they're hearing their parents say crazy stuff and they're checking it. So they should be applauded, but we need to continue these efforts to ensure that our country continues toward progress and doesn't reverse.
You touched on exactly where I wanted to go, which was, we now have a new administration, Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris. And I will tell you, I was boohooing. I was crying watching that, because knowing the story that I told you and knowing how discarded my mom felt for most of her adult life, to see a Black woman reach that pinnacle, I felt like it was a vindication of everything that she's gone through. And I know I live my life making sure that her experience was not in vain. And I think a lot of Black boys, especially to their mothers, feel that same way. But what should young people be demanding? There's a lot of young people, especially on the left, especially some progressives, who feel like, this is kind of the moderate lane and there's nothing that's going to change here. And there's some that don't think we'll go far enough. How should young people be framing this time, and what should we be demanding?
Look, I think that young people have always been, like, we have to remember, MLK was assassinated under 40. Most of our famed civil rights leaders were in their teens and 20s. John Lewis was in his teens when he was doing what he was doing. Rosa Parks was young. The current Black Lives Matter activists who people know, the women's rights activists, the gun rights activists, the environmental activists are all young. There's a reason for that, because society hasn't imprinted you yet with what your potential limits could be. So when I think about what they should be demanding is true equality in every way and at every turn, in every form. And part of that is setting expectations for elected officials. I think that's one thing, which I think is happening. And I think President Biden and VP Harris are doing that. I mean, they've essentially created pretty much the most diverse, racial and ethnically, and most diverse cabinet as it relates to gender that we've seen, particularly in the positions where they're at. I think the other thing, they need to demand equitable policies, and also need to demand policies that deal with the historical ramifications of racial inequality. Reparations, for example, is a big one. That's on the table right now. H.R. 40, H.Con. Resolution 100, Those are bills that are in the House of Representatives that have the votes that could pass. I think the Senate will take it up as well. I also think on criminal justice reform, they should be demanding that the Department of Justice conduct swift investigations and hand down consent decrees of police departments that have engaged in egregious forms of racial discrimination. I think that will happen. The Department of Justice is being led by former Judge Garland, and then also three women of all different ethnic groups who are running the DOJ. I mean, this is time for change. I think people should also be demanding that, look, we have to get student loans under control. There's no reason why someone should go to college and come out of college with over $200,000 in debt. We also know that there's been predatory lending for school loans and for housing. So in addition to student loan forgiveness, we also need to transform the way that housing loans are being given out, which some of that has already been happening under COVID. But this is what it looks like to deal with the intersections of race, class, and gender, because they're not in a vacuum. It's that it's about race, yeah, but it's about gender and it's about social class. And the intersectional identities that young people have today can help us move forward in thinking about corrective action, right? Distributive justice, restitution for past actions, like what your mom experienced, like what my mom experienced, to ensure that those sort of things don't happen to our kids and their grandkids and great-grandkids, we need to put equitable policies in place. I also think voting is one of the final things that I'll mention. We got to ensure that the number of people who are able to come out for this election get the opportunity to come out in the next 2 years, the next 4 years, the next 8, 12, so forth and so on. Because there are some conservatives who are going to try to double down on voting rights, like in places like Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, even in the Midwest, where we know that overwhelmingly Black people, whether you're talking about Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Georgia, helped to win this election for the Democrats, not just the presidency, but also control of the Senate and continuous control of the House. So ensuring that means we need to have a John Lewis Voting Rights Act. It needs to be permanent. It doesn't need to expire after, you know, 25 or 35 years, 40 years, like the Voting Rights Act of 1965 did. Instead, it needs to stay in place so that policies and legislations like Shelby versus Holder cannot prevent people from voting. Because look, this is the bottom line with voting. Yeah, Joe Biden got the most votes ever, but Donald Trump got the second most votes ever. So what's clear is that our democracy is not just working for one group of people or one type of person. It's working for everyone. It just so happened Biden beat Trump. But who knows, the next time the Republican might win. But the more people who have the right to participate in our democracy is what true democracy looks like.
We just have, I mean, just incredible. We have a few moments left, and I just want to ask you kind of this final question here. If you could go back maybe to the beginning of these past 4 years and tell yourself anything about what was ahead, what would the warning be? What would the advice be?
That's a great question. The past 4 years have been tough, most definitely, for our country and the world. I mean, I guess what I would say is to be prepared for the unexpected and continue to double down to get yourself fit to engage in social justice and equity work. You know, people who do this work, it's difficult. I mean, we go into the lion's den every single day, whether that be interacting with people who don't like us, who don't want us there. These are difficult spaces to be in. And I mean, I could have stories for days about that. So I would say prepare for the unexpected. But one thing that I'll also say is that when you prepare hard and you work hard, when situations pop up like what we've seen over the past few years, for me, my work, my research, and me as a scholar, I was ready for it because my work, I've been doing this work for over a decade on health disparities, on policing, on racism for well over a decade, that it was a perfect storm of the work that I do. And I think if I could go back 4 years and say something, I would say, do everything you're doing, but do it sooner and do it even bigger. Because I think in the academy, we get caught up being in the ivory tower. We don't step out a lot. We think everybody should come to us. You know, we have a garnered audience. We have all these students. We have other scholars. But there's an entire world out there that can't have access to the type of things that we do. So I would say some of the things that I've done over the past couple of years that starting in 2016, I was thinking about and I was kind of doing and I was stepping out, but I would have done that even sooner and even more aggressively at that point is probably what I would say.
Dr. Rayshon Ray, I mean, this has just been one of my favorite conversations ever on this show. Thank you for giving us your wisdom, sharing your stories of courage, and giving us as young people the kind of plan, a starting of a plan of what we can demand in our future. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Rayshon Ray is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute. Until next time, bye everybody.